Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It has been a monumental week for Washington and the country. The president's immigration reform, dead again. Ted Kennedy asked what its opponents are for.
They ought to be able to explain to the American people what they are for. What are they going to do with the 12.5 million who are undocumented here? Send them back?
At the Supreme Court, an about-face on race, integration, and American schools, tearful Seattle mother and winning plaintiff Kathleen Brose welcomed the change.
And if this nation is ever going to move beyond race, we're going to have to stop using race as a decision on what schools our kids are going to get into.
And down Pennsylvania Avenue, a standoff between Congress and the White House over subpoenas and presidential power, Senator Patrick Leahy.
Increasingly, the president and the vice president feel they're above the law. In America, no one is above the law.
We've got a great panel with us today. Joining me now from Washington is Gail Chadwick, senior congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, welcome back. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
With us from Dallas, Texas is William McKenzie, editorial page columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Bill, always great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Welcome, Jack.
Hi, Tom, Gail, and Bill.
Gail Chadwick, first to you, where to begin? I mean, there is so much this week. Just look out there. We've got big stuff going on between the Supreme Court on race, immigration going down, Richard Lugar speaking up on the Iraq War. Where to begin, Gail?
I'll tell you, I was struck on the way in this morning reading the Washington Post. It had a banner headline, "Divided Court Limits Use of Race by School Districts." And then immigration bill dies in the Senate, and then Bush may be out of chances for a lasting domestic victory. And I thought, you know, the banner headline, "Use of Race by School Districts," is the Bush legacy. You know, immigration, even the subpoenas, this is trivial stuff compared to the long-term impact on the judiciary of the Bush presidency.
With a new court, the New York Times today calls it the radical new majority on the court. Love it or not, there's the claim, Bill McKenzie. It's hard to call immigration trivial. It's hard to call presidential powers trivial, and yet we have so many big elephants in the room this week.
Right, right. No, it is a big, big news week. It kind of makes you wonder what July will be like in comparison.
Yeah.
It'd be hard to top this.
Yeah.
I would quarrel with the notion that immigration is not a big deal. I mean, certainly the long-lasting influence of Supreme Court justices, nobody can quarrel with that. But this immigration thing is really long-lasting. I love the quote that you let in with by Ted Kennedy, because he also goes on in that same speech to say, you know, what are the opponents going to do with the 12 million who are undocumented here? Send them back to countries around the world, develop a type of Gestapo here to seek out these people? What's their alternative? And that is really the issue, because if we have no solution for the next 2 or 3 years, and it looks like that's going to be the case, well, then we're looking at another 1 million more illegal immigrants. We have about 400,000 who are coming here illegally each year. We're looking at employers continuing to wink at laws trying to certify whether somebody is legal or not. We may end up with fewer agents along the border because that was a big part of this bill. You know, so there are a lot of there are a lot of repercussions to failure to act, and that's going to really impact a lot of communities, a lot of states. We're probably going to see more states and local communities like we've seen here in Texas come up with their own solutions. I'm not in the camp of having that happen. I don't think these solutions have been good. It's a federal problem. The federal government ought to solve it.
Jack Beattie, repercussions not only for the 12 million undocumented workers, but for all Americans living with this, and now all Americans who will live with the Supreme Court decision, all Americans looking on as Congress and the president square off over executive privilege. These are huge irons in the fire, but where are we going here, Jack?
Well, you know, to me, this was a week of retreat from reform in politics, law, and society. Labor law reform was stymied. in the Senate by a Republican filibuster. That was a defeat not only for unions, but for equality. A leading historian of Rome has said that the fall of Rome can be compassed in three words: fewer had more. The Senate, as we said, killed immigration reform, leaving 12 million illegals in the shadow of fear. 50 years after the Little Rock school integration crisis, the Supreme Court set back the cause of integration, defeating local efforts to mitigate the effects of racial isolation. 100 years after Teddy Roosevelt signed a law banning corporate contributions to political campaigns, the court gave a green light to corporate contributions to political campaigns, eviscerating the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform act. You know, reform is the capacity of the American system to identify and solve problems before disasters come, before chaos comes. And this week's events, it seems to me, have weakened belief in that possibility.
Gail Chadwick, take us to, we'll look at each of these. Let's go to immigration first. Here we were on Tuesday. There were 64 votes to bring this back from what had been seen as nearly the dead. It seemed as though the grand bargain, the grand compromise, might be pushed through somehow. Then yesterday, 14 votes shy or something like that of what was needed to actually push ahead. What happened? Where did those missing votes go?
Well, I actually like the term that Jack just used, the definition of reform as identifying and solving problems. Many of those, and I talked to lots of them after the vote, had said that they voted for cloture to go ahead with the bill because they thought that reform was essential. They supported the concept of comprehensive reform, but they thought the bill really needed to be fixed, that it needed to be amended. There were some important amendments to be raised. And yet, the whole week, very little was done in terms of seriously amending that bill. Now, this is going to be studied for a long time. Did the majority leader make a mistake in telling the U.S. Senate, I am going to determine which amendments you can raise? This hadn't been done in quite this form before. It's arcane for listeners, but it outraged many senators to think that they would not be able to choose themselves which amendments to raise. And as a result, a lot of the vetting of this bill, unlike the one that came up last year, did not go through a committee process. So members haven't had a chance to really dig into that grand bargain that was pretty much concocted in behind closed doors. With the White House, that they wanted to do. You know, it was interesting to see Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff and the Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez on opposite sides of the door as senators walked through, lobbying them, even double-teaming them.
Wow.
But really, by Thursday, it was too late, because for many of these senators, they were just upset that they were not able to change significantly the bargain that had been made. And the leaders that were back of it were concerned that with each vote, this very delicate compromise could be unraveled, that some of the amendments they kept off the floor were kept off precisely because they would have won and unraveled the bargain.
And so at the end of the day, we have this unsolved and giant problem. Gail, I want to listen to some of the voices that came off that Senate floor this week, if I may. Here yesterday on the Senate floor, Alan Spector saying the bill was the best way to deal with people who are in the U.S. illegally.
These 12 million are going to be here whether we legislate or not. So if it is amnesty, to do nothing is to have silent amnesty. They're going to stay here. And to do nothing is to perpetuate anarchy.
Anarchy or amnesty? Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas said the bill clearly provided amnesty to illegal immigrants, and she did not support it.
If you can come to this country, stay, never have to go home, and go into the process of legalization and going into our Social Security program, which is allowed in the underlying bill, that is amnesty.
Okay, but what are we going to do? Democrat Senator Chuck Schumer of New York lamenting nothing.
It's a sad day when we can't be constructive and do something that everyone in this country knows needs to be done.
Bill McKenzie, there in Texas, you look at immigration square in the face. You were very, very strong for this and see traces of where George Bush has been before on immigration here.
Right. This was what we saw a lot of as Bush's governor. And I raise that because people oftentimes say, well, whatever happened to the guy who was governor? We kind of voted for him for that reason because he was going to be uniter or divider. Well, here we had Bush working with Ted Kennedy and building a coalition from the center out. And Gail was talking about, you know, there's some senators frustrated. Well, you know, these things are never pretty. We had John Kyle, a conservative from Arizona, along with Ted Kennedy, along with Arlen Specter, along with Lindsey Graham. We had them across the board. What was going on was this coalition that was going to, again, be built from the center out. This was a lot like what happened down here in 1997 when Bush picked a fight on school finance. A lot of Republicans said, leave it alone. Don't touch it. Don't do it. He said, look, we got to do it because this problem is going to get worse as we go along. And indeed, it took us 10 years before we ever got to a school finance settlement down here. And who stuck it to him in the school finance thing down here were the Senate Republicans. They wouldn't, as one told me later, I wasn't going to drink the Kool-Aid on the solution he had dealing with taxes. Well, the same thing has happened up here on immigration. He has picked a battle and said, look, this is a problem we have got to solve. It's not going to go away. And unfortunately, most within his own party were the ones who undermined it.
We're looking at a big week in the news. Immigration goes down. The Supreme Court on race and schools subpoenas for the White House. Let's listen to a little of the sound of response to the Supreme Court's decision on using race in the schools to balance race in the schools. First, we go to Kathleen Brose. We heard a little bit of her at the top. She was one of the plaintiffs suing the Seattle School District because her daughter was rejected by schools. She celebrated yesterday's court decision, said it was unfair that her daughter could not attend the neighborhood school.
They didn't look at her academic needs. They just looked at her skin color and said, we're going to place you over here because we need you over here. There's a certain amount of diversity in our neighborhood, and the kids that were categorized non-white were able to get into the local schools, and the kids who were categorized white weren't able to. And those kids knew that. It affected friendships. Once I filed the lawsuit, I had some people unhappy with me, and it affected some of my friendships.
Okay, it affected her friendships. It will affect the whole country sooner or later. Here's Mary Myers, a mother from Louisville, Kentucky, has two teenage children in a school affected by the court's decision. She says she's willing to accept busing to ensure integrated schools.
This is the price that we pay to have a fair education, and I think it's a price that people are willing to pay. Our children are fine with this. Leave these children alone. Let them go to school together. It's more than after they come out to learn the education, they got to go into the workforce and work together. They'll see all kind of people. I mean, we have to stop this madness and let these children grow up in the desegregated schools. They go into a desegregated workforce. Well, this country is on a bad road with this. It's a bad decision.
Tim Shaw of the NAACP expressed dismay at the court's decision, said it showed a rift on the court.
There's an ideological war going on here with respect to not only the place of race in this country, but whether we should be able to do anything to address racial inequality on a voluntary basis.
Gil Chadwick, Chief Justice John Roberts, wrote, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discrimination on the basis of race. Let's just be done with this race card, he said.
Many elements of this came out in his when he first came before the Senate Judiciary Committee in one of the most kind of brilliant performances that anyone had seen up there. But after all of the great answers, there was a lot of talk about, well, what will he do when he actually has the authority to shape decisions on the court? And I think this one is a very critical one. Because in effect, what he's saying is the legacy of the past, you know, is over now. There's no more work that the court needs to do to equalize a school situation. We can simply affirm the principle of race blind. Now, that's not simply a decision for the court to make, but the court has often the last word in the sequence of a debate. And when talking to senators yesterday about it, many of them were so caught up in immigration that they hadn't had a chance to even think about this decision. But Senator Kennedy, in his speech just before the immigration vote, looked out on his colleagues and he said, look at the issues that have been settled on the Senate floor. Racial discrimination, you know, sex, gender, and so forth. This is the legacy of the Senate. And I think you will certainly see members go back and try to pick at this decision in all kinds of ways, beginning with the No Child Left Behind Act, which is coming up for reauthorization, trying to just build back into the education system aspects that will make opportunity truly equal, not just equal on paper.
Bill McKenzie, is this Brown versus Board of Education thrown into reverse? Are we headed back? I mean, we have widely segregated schools, even with the status quo kind of actions, interventions that we've had. With this, are we headed back to, I don't know, all white, all black, all brown schools all over? Bill?
I agree with Justice Roberts. I think, though, what is important to remember is we do have five justices who are...
Sounds like we've got a problem with that line. Jack, how are you looking at this decision?
Well, you know, it was really, in some ways, a 4-4-1 decision, the one being Justice Kennedy. He you know, really is now Justice Kennedy's court and country in some ways. And he does not turn down on its face the idea of racial diversity as an important goal that should be advanced by public policy. He says you just have to pay attention to how it is done. It has to be tailored in such a way that it does not make race seem the overwhelmingly salient character. Proxies for race can be used. And, of course, one of them is class and economic circumstances. And more and more people are saying that, you know, schools can be integrated in a judge-proof way if you use economic status as a way to shape up your student body. Now, whether it would work out to the kinds of ratios that you had in Louisville or not, I don't know. But I think more and more school districts will look to that after this decision.
Well, there we are. Let's take a call here, if I may, from Boston. Dean is on the line. Dean, are you there?
I'm here, Tom.
Hi, what do you see, Dean?
Well, I just wanted to offer a little different perspective because I think we need one in this discussion. And my perspective is this, is that when Jack Beatty earlier referred to this week as a retreat from reform, I feel the opposite. I feel that this decision was a reform in a way of a policy that is reflective of 50 years ago. And not necessarily today. In fact,
Dean, you're looking at the Supreme Court's race and schools decision.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Because what I feel as though that they simply applied the strict scrutiny test that would be applied to any case where, you know, government is making decisions based on race in this case. And they basically said, you know, you had made, I don't think you actually said the words, Tom, but you had said the word reverse a couple of minutes ago in some context. And, you know, we've heard over the years recently the term reverse discrimination. And what this does, in my opinion, is kind of take the reverse out of that and just call it what it is, discrimination.
But Dean, are you then ready? Do you think the country is then ready to move beyond race, as Justice Roberts suggests? We don't need to consider it anymore. Let the chips fall where they may.
You know, I really do, and I'm not going to bore you with the story. But I mean, I really identify with somebody that, you know, has not been really given anything, and it was up to me to, you know, pay for my own college, go to community college, go to, you know, pay for law school on my own, and I did it without anybody else's help, and I think that that's the American way. I'm not saying that government shouldn't, you know, help out the public and so forth, but not based on race.
Jack, that flag has been raised for a long time, and there it is again today, celebrating this, not the reverse.
Yes, and that's the equal protection of the laws. And if you favor one race over another, isn't that on its face against the 14th Amendment? On the other side of that is the notion that the status quo is not sanctified, that the status quo in the country is flawed by our long history of white over black, and we can't deny it. I think Harry Blackmun put this so well years ago when he said, we have to pay attention to race in order to get beyond race. You know, we can't just deny that we've had American history, slavery, segregation, all the rest. And to dismantle that and the structures of the psychological and social structures built around it, we still live with those things. And Justice Roberts seemed to be saying, okay, let's just pretend none of that is there and let's just deal with the abstract issues raised by the 14th Amendment. It felt abstract and not engaged with the realities of our society.
There's the chasm back after all these years and running right through the debate on the Supreme Court and right through the population. Let's go to Providence, Rhode Island, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to make comment on your earlier topic about the immigration
yes.
bill, and one I've in Rhode Island been very involved in. And I really resent a lot of the senators saying, you know, that this is a vote for no action. What I think a lot of the American people mm-hmm. want, really, and this goes Democrat, Republican, Independent, is to enforce the laws we have in the book to control the border and go after these employers. That's just a start. I don't think we needed to do this grand amnesty as part of the whole bill. And Chuck Schumer saying, okay, we're going to do nothing. I think people want to do something, but they don't want to grant amnesty. People just walked over the border in January 2007.
No, I hear that, John. I understand it. But what do you do with 12 million people who are in the country? You know, John McCain called it silent amnesty, or if we do nothing, de facto amnesty? Do we end up living with the second-class citizens who mow the yards and we sit in a special status above looking down and that's just their problem?
Could I tell you that?
Please.
And a lot of people have debated this now for a few months. What I think is the right thing to do is you start with the employers, you go after them big, you find them. Now that if the jobs aren't there, there will be a large percentage of people that will find their way back to where they came from, and I think that's the first start as far as kind of cleaning the situation up. Now, if other people stay, you can use some of that money to either help get them back to their home countries or possibly put some services in that are going to help us all. But this was an economic issue that is killing every city in the country, school-wise and healthcare, and we can't afford it. That's why I was so against it.
John, we hear it. Let me put it to Gail Chadwick. Gail, is that the voice that turned so many senators yesterday against it?
Yes, I think it is. It's interesting to me how much of the coverage is focused on the Republicans that voted against the bill. 15 Democrats and an Independent did as well, and they are not extremists. We're talking about heartland Democrats, Byron Dorgan, Jim Webb from Virginia, Claire McCaskill, Pryor, Tester from Montana, Jeff Bingaman, you know, hardly anybody's idea of a radical. And what moved many of these people was the sense that their constituents felt that they were just being rolled over by a national government that would not enforce the border, would not carefully look at employers' requests for H-1B visas, was outsourcing their jobs, outsourcing basically the middle class. That's how they see the world, that Washington is simply not listening to them. I really don't think, as I talk to even some of the conservative Republicans, that the baseline here was wanting to hurt immigrants or simply punish them. I think it was an order that we need to win back the confidence of the American people by enforcing the laws that we have. Michael Chertoff, in a kind of emotional statement that wasn't reported, after the vote, said, look, I have a job to do. I have to enforce the laws. This comprehensive reform would have helped me a lot, but I will go ahead and enforce the laws that we have. I will continue to bring criminal cases against employers in record numbers, but our society is going to continue to see heartbreaking examples of families being torn apart. And I think that is why, in my view, this is not dead. That more than 1,000 cities and states, 1,000 laws are bubbling along out there, anything from sanctuary cities to cities that are going after anyone who vaguely looks illegal, tooth and tong. That is intolerable in the long run for our society as well. Business groups are terribly afraid of it. They are not going to let this die because business cannot live in an environment where you can be arrested, you know, any minute for employing people who are not legal.
Well, when so many businesses employ these people, but
that's right.
Gosh, there's the division. You say it's not dead, Gail. When, how might it come back? Could it come back? And in what form next time? Would it look anything like this time?
Well, I think in the end, you'll see a lot of pressure to pick off, kind of cherry pick from the agreement, things that people can agree on. Most emphatically, the border stuff. I mean, I think one of the most interesting points that Jeff Sessions made, a senator from Alabama, was look at the border security aspects of this law. You know, build 370 miles of fence. It already is the law to build 700 miles of fence. Why haven't we done that? Another feature of the law, to have a system to check visas entering and leaving the country so that we can know if people have actually left. That's already law. That was supposed to have been done 2 years ago. So I think a lot of the immediate impact, and you saw a hearing on this in the House this week, is to go back to the government and say, why don't we have a visa system yet? What is happening with this fence? So even without Congress doing a single thing in terms of new legislating, just the pressure to legislate the laws that exist will do something along the lines that critics of the bill wanted to see.
I think we've got Bill McKenzie back in Dallas. Sorry we lost you, Bill. We've had callers saying, come on, let's just enforce the laws and tighten up the border, and the rest of this was secondary. But you were very strong for this bill. What about just enforcing the law and tightening the border?
You know, I heard the caller, and I think you really have to see the border to know why that's not going to work. You could build 700 miles of fence, and you're not going to stop the flow of 400,000 people coming over here illegally. And it's very instructive to me that you have seen politicians from both parties in every border state say, look, this is not the answer. And the reason you can't solve this, you cannot solve this problem without some sort of temporary guest worker program, because we just don't have enough tools to solidly enforce it.
But you had your senators lining up ultimately against this package. Why?
Right, and I've argued against them. I think they are wrong on it, although you will hear Hutchinson and Cornyn both say that what I just said is that a wall is not going to stop it. And so that what they were arguing about was the $12 million, whether they should have to go back home or not. They weren't necessarily arguing against the guest worker program. My point is the guest worker program is so central to this. This is the one that would certify workers who are coming in the future, not the ones who are here now, to give to legalize a flow. And my point is you cannot secure the border the way conservatives want it secured unless you have a guest worker program. If you go into the interior of Mexico and you see where many people are living, there is a reason they are coming here. They are coming for very understandable human reasons. You cannot build a wall high enough to stop that flow of people. You cannot have enough agents to stop that flow of people. You have to almost see the contours and the geography of the border. I'm going down there on Sunday, and it's reinforced to me every time I go there how difficult it would be just to have only a border security. I think, if I may say so, I think that is a bit of a myth. And it's generally a myth held by people who just haven't had a chance to see what the situation is there along the border and also in the interior of Mexico. Yeah. It's just not possible without a guest worker program.
Fair enough. And they're trying to get that through. But then we saw even in Midland, Texas, they had reporters down reporting that the town where George Bush spent so much of his childhood, where he went back to as a young man, where he shaped his opinions, open to this kind of reform. Now that town is turned against Bush on reform. They feel overwhelmed by immigration.
Correct. We see the same thing here in Dallas. However, if you look at polls, you look at polls nationally, and even look at some polls here in Texas, when you lay out the contours of lay out the pieces of this bill and talk to them about what it is about, people strongly support what the elements of the bill were about. And so the question I have is, will this issue still have legs in next November, in November 2008 in the election? I don't know. That's a while away. But if I were Republicans, I'd be worrying about which way the Latino vote is going. I'd particularly be concerned about which way Latino evangelicals who have been coming their way. I talked to a number of Latino evangelical pastors over last week. they're hot about this thing. I think you also need to, the Democrats need to be thinking about this hard, because if they don't have some legislative triumphs, you know, they're exposed on this thing too. It is their bill also. It is Harry Reid's bill. It's Ted Kennedy's bill.
We're looking at a big week in the news. Immigration goes down, the Supreme Court on race and schools, subpoenas for the White House, and much more. Apple's iPhone goes on sale today. Some customers already waiting in line for days.
My boyfriend's the one that wants the phone, so I'm unemployed, so I got voted to come wait.
In Texas, big flooding and hard rescues.
There was people that were hanging in trees and on the roofs of their sheds and homes, and we couldn't get to them at first till we got boats out there, so that was pretty dramatic.
And in London, Tony Blair tells Parliament goodbye.
And I wish everyone, friend or foe, well, and that is that, the end.
Let's take a couple of calls here from Moline, Illinois. David, you're on the air.
Hello, thanks for taking my phone call.
Yeah.
I'd like to say that we had the same arguments about needing second-class citizens before the Civil War. And there, again, it was, it began as a humanitarian aspect. The people that they imported then were going to wind up on the table, eaten in their homeland, and then it got twisted to something bad. I'm afraid that this will also be twisted to something bad and horrible. These people are human beings. They shouldn't be second-class citizens. We need to treat them humanely and give them opportunities, but they need to be legal, and it needs to be done correctly.
We hear the view. If they're here and if they're working, you say, don't leave them second class. And we've got it. David, thanks very much for that. I want to move to Tom in Columbia, South Carolina. Tom, you're on the air. You're looking at the subpoenas that George Bush has got from Congress this week.
Yes, and I think potentially if Congress will exert its power as an equal branch of government, it could be the biggest story. I understand executive privilege is not usable when there's an underlying crime, and arguably with Attorney Gate, you've got obstruction of justice in San Diego and potential prosecutorial misconduct in New Mexico. And is it just me, or is it just a coincidence that days after Ashcroft testified in private concerning the illegal wiretapping, that those subpoenas just went out? So
you say, Mr. President, open the door. Gil Chadwick, what about it? Remind us of what Congress wants and exactly what the White House has said in reply.
Congress is beginning what I think will be a flurry of subpoenas for the rest of the Bush administration. Then the question is, how much time does this occupy, both congressional time and the White House time? Right now, it's two areas. One, the firing of U.S. attorneys. The more Congress digs into this, the more inconsistent answers that they're getting. But it hasn't really caught on with the general public. The second issue is the legal authority for a terrorist surveillance program. Same thing. The more Congress digs into it, the more inconsistent answers they get. The Attorney General first said that there wasn't dissent within the Justice Department about this program. We find out now that there was quite a bit of it. So I think there's plenty of digging for Congress to do on this front. It goes straight to the heart of executive congressional relations. But as you mentioned earlier, it also goes to the heart of what Congress can achieve if they spend the last year and a half of the Bush administration fighting over these issues. Will they be able to get anything signed by way of a record for their own 2 years in power?
Of course, that goes for the president, too. Bill McKenzie, is this where George Bush should be, you know, throwing down for his last year and a half, couple years in office around the power of the presidency?
No, absolutely not. I think they've picked the wrong battle. I don't know why they, you know, maybe in a textbook sense they have some points to argue about executive power versus congressional power coming out of Watergate and all of that. But look, you know, when you're 25% in the polls up until yesterday, you still had immigration on the table. You still have No Child Left Behind, which is a very significant piece of legislation coming up. And you've got to come up with a new strategy for Iraq. The surge is not going to satisfy enough people by September. That's pretty clear. You need all your power that you have left to try to get some of these things done. You don't really need to have a big battle over executive power. I think this is a Cheney deal. I think he is ill-serving his president.
Let's listen to Senator Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, which issued subpoenas asking for documents this week about warrantless wiretapping. He said the American public deserves answers on this.
Vice President Cheney has said that the president doesn't have to answer to either the courts or the Congress if he's acting somehow as commander-in-chief in a never-ending war on terror. Well, that's, you know, there's never been such a claim by any president in the history of the country. It certainly is contrary to everything. We've said, well, you have checks and balances in a government, and I want to know how many areas where they've totally ignored the law.
Senator Patrick Leahy, let's go to Barb in Goose Creek, South Carolina. Barb, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment about the executive decision. He's been such a very limited with information throughout all the years that he's been president. Why does it surprise you that he would evoke executive decision over something that he doesn't want us to know?
Executive privilege now, and he certainly is, yeah.
You know?
So the same old from this president, you say, but so there he stands. Gail Chadwick, who breaks this logjam, if that's what it is? Do the courts step in and choose? And if it's this, if it goes to this Supreme Court, is there a question how it would decide?
Well, that's of course the important point. If it gets into a court fight, and, you know, this hasn't come up. We're talking about criminal contempt. We're talking about a court battle that will go on that basis more than a year and a half, you know, through the end of the Bush presidency. In the cases where this has come up in the past, it's typically been settled by negotiation, and that's what Senator Specter, who is on the, you know, the ranking Republican on that committee, is trying to do at that point. He's trying to get some of the Democrats to step down a little bit on these issues. Don't demand a transcript necessarily. He says, let's hear what the president has to say, and then what the president's aides have to say, and then go forward. But if you get into a court fight, that's, you know, the game over for the rest of this administration and beyond.
But Jack Beatty, we are setting precedents with or without a court here now that the gauntlets are thrown down.
We are, and, you know, I mean, it's just clear that in the attorney gate, they're hiding things. They're hiding the degree to which Karl Rove and his shop at the White House were trying to use this the U.S. attorneys as a political for political patronage and to advance their electoral interests, and they're hiding something crucial on the wiretapping. I mean, this is what brought John Ashcroft from the depths of his pain in the hospital bed to say, no, you can't do this. Well, what was the thing he said no to? What were they doing that had Ashcroft, that had his assistant, that had the FBI head all saying no? What were these people doing? And the inference is that they were doing something, and yet we're not, I think, because of the procedure, we're not going to the Bush is going to run out the clock on this, and there may be some compromise where testimony is given, but no record is kept. But all of that, it just doesn't seem to me serves the public interest in disclosure and transparency and in accountability.
There was another no on Capitol Hill this week from a surprising quarter, perhaps, in a speech on Monday after most everybody had gone. Republican Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, a very respected voice on foreign affairs, caused a big stir. He stood up and said President Bush's Iraq strategy is not working.
In my judgment, the costs and risks continuing down the current path outweigh the potential benefits that might be achieved. Persisting indefinitely with the surge strategy will delay policy adjustments that have a better chance of protecting our vital interests over the long term.
Bill McKenzie talking about running out the clock. Here was Lugar standing up, very respected on this front. He's been opposed but quiet. Now he's public. Other Republicans as well, Voinovich of Ohio and others. What does it mean for President Bush? Will his own party actually turn his policy on the war?
Well, I think they, meaning the White House, need to be considering Plan B and Plan C, and I'm not saying they're not doing that, because when you talk to you mentioned Lugar, you talk to other Republicans, as I have, I mean, they're underneath all of this, there is a frustration that, look, the surge is not going to be where we want it to be in September. I mean, there is an argument to be made as the surge has been successful in selective ways, but we don't have the troops to make the surge work in the way we really need. So what is going to be the alternative? And perhaps it is a return to the Iraq Study Group report, which would to say, look, you know, withdraw some of these troops and leave about 80,000 there to strike and fight al-Qaeda. And put the rest in Kuwait and on and deploy them on ships or put them along the border to stop the guns coming in from the from Iran and Syria. There are a number of different strategies you could use versus bring them all back home to Fort Hood or Fort Bragg, which I think most people, a sane person would say, look, we don't want to have a gaping hole in the Mideast. We're going to have some presence there to stop this thing. And they need to be thinking about it. They need to be ready in September to September, October to come up with Plan B.
I'm reading others saying, Republicans saying, it won't even be September or October. It may have to be over the summer when something new happens. Gail, what about it? When Richard Lugar speaks, does it make a difference to George W. Bush?
What's interesting about Lugar is that he said privately to President Bush, along with John Warner of Virginia, three of them in the Oval Office, he said privately exactly, back in January, exactly what he said publicly this week. So the interesting question is what happened between January and June. Lugar is someone who works behind the scenes. He doesn't like to embarrass presidents, not just this one, any president. He'll give them his best thinking behind the scenes in the interest of some sort of constructive engagement with Congress. And to my mind, that's the part of the speech that wasn't really reported. Yes, he said directly to the president, our course in Iraq has lost contact with our vital national security interests. That's huge. But to his colleagues in the Congress, he said, we need a constructive engagement with this president. Lugar was the one who, before the war, was held hearing after hearing that said to White House officials, what's your plan once you get there? And now he's on the other side, what's your plan to get out? And he's saying to his colleagues as well, it's not enough just to have a great slogan for the next campaign that the president botched the war. You know, a lot of people already think that. But what we need is your thought working with this president to come up with an exit strategy that makes sense for our national interests. So it's really an appeal both on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue to the president to get back in contact with with reality in a way that that Lugar must think he isn't or he wouldn't have gone public, and to his colleagues to stop just planning their ads for the next campaign and to really engage with what kind of possible constructive way out there is in this situation.
So there's a Republican perspective. Jack, the Democrats, of course, in debate last night or in a forum at Howard University, a lot of them speaking up against the Supreme Court decision. But they've got Congress now. They also didn't get immigration out this week. They haven't managed to turn the course on the war. In all these big doings, where do you see the weight of the Democrats turning in terms of policy, in terms of people? Do they have an answer?
I don't think they do. And Congress's popularity is now beneath the president's. Many reasons for that. Maybe people are impatient. People don't, they want the war ended yesterday. And I think this is a big problem for the Democratic Party. And I'm afraid that this defeat of the immigration bill has empowered sort of the wreckers in the Senate. That is, Republicans who don't want the Democrats to have a record. And I'm thinking of people like Jim DeMint, who just after the immigration bill died, he objected. And because they have unanimous consent rules in the Senate, that meant nothing could happen. He objected to a 93-2 vote that they had made on ethics reform that now he said can't go forward because he has an objection to it. It was like stopping something just for the sake of stopping it. I'm afraid that kind of feeling may be empowered now in the Senate.
Well, a big week, and I thank each of you for being with us. Gail Chadwick with the Christian Science Monitor, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you all.
Bill McKenzie in Dallas, thanks, Bill, for being here.
Thank you very much.
Jack, good as always to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.